Welcome to Pilot Points, a podcast for turbine pilot issues. In the June issue of Professional Pilot Magazine, readers, all ostensibly professional pilots, responded to the following questions. What experience have you had landing on contaminated runways? And second, what do you think of FAA's proposed 15% add-on requirement? After reviewing the responses, almost all dealing with the second question, it took me a couple of days to digest what I read. I was left with the impression that most pilots, at least those who were responding, do not really understand the issue. There were three general camps that the responses fell into. But before I get into them, let me just clarify something. There is no proposed rule at present. A policy change was published in the Federal Registry on June 7, 2006, and was later rescinded due to a large outcry from industry groups. An aviation rulemaking committee, spearheaded by Jerry Astronik of AFS 200, and 40 members of various affected groups, was established to come up with recommendations for a possible future rule. A SAFO, number 612, which recommends all the original notice points, including the 15% add-on assessment, does exist, as does the FAA's encouragement to voluntarily comply with OPSPEC C-382, which was similar to the original OPSPEC draft. No recommendations have come out of the ARC as of yet, and this subject will probably need to be revisited soon. Currently, fewer than half of all turbine operators perform any landing distance calculations upon destination arrival, and of those who do, 70% do not add any safety margins to those calculations. Now, on to the responses. The first group of respondents suggested that, quote, just following the AFM was adequate. In my book, Aircraft Performance, Myths and Methods, I spent a good deal of time diplomatically describing the optimistic tendency of the landing numbers in the AFM. But time constraints of this podcast do not allow me this flexibility. So let me just put it this way. There's a reason, much of it related to the landing phase, why test pilots wear helmets, special seatbelt harnesses, and jumpsuits. Apparently, the jumpsuits are needed to keep clothing from being torn away during the rapid deceleration. I'm exaggerating, obviously, to get your attention, but only slightly. While the regs regarding the certification of aircraft specifically prohibits either super piloting abilities or brakes, every technique is exploited to its legal limit to keep the landing distance as short as possible. In fact, AFM landing distances are a testament of how short the aircraft can land. Let me give you a couple of examples. The approach gradient is steeper than normal, and the descent rate can be as high as 8 feet per second. Doesn't sound too bad until you put it into a more familiar term of 480 feet per minute. Can you imagine touching down at that rate with the boss in the back, followed immediately by a maximum effort braking? Consider this. The runway aiming point markers are 1,000 feet from the threshold. Assuming a 50-foot screen height, this computes to 300 feet per nautical mile. At a VREF of 125 knots, you would have to be descending at 625 feet per minute to touch down within 1,000 feet of the threshold. That's why most tire marks fall beyond the big white bars. Go to a runway where certification tests are done and tell me where the tire marks appear. The moral of this story is that the AFM landing distance values do not reflect normal operational practices. The second camp of respondents believe that the 60 and 80% rules provide adequate safety margins. Commercial operators are universally familiar with the requirement to be able to land within 60% of the runway, but most have forgotten that this is a pre-flight dispatching requirement and applies to the longest, dry, most favorable, i.e. uphill direction, runway with no wind, or the most suitable runway with the expected wind. If an alternate that meets these requirements is filed, the aircraft can be dispatched even if it does not meet the requirement at the intended destination. So there really has never been a requirement for the pilot to apply actual data to actual conditions on the actual runway. Once the aircraft is dispatched, it's largely pilot discretion, without further regulated safety margins, whether the landing distance is adequate. Few Part 91 operators voluntarily incorporate the 60 or 80% rule in their dispatching procedures. Even when the conditions have not changed and the longest runway is used, the safety margin afforded using the 60% rule can easily be eaten up by diverging from the landing configuration assumptions. One transport category aircraft data showed that a descent rate 1 foot per second less than the assumed 8 feet per second, a glide slope of 0.5 degree lower than the assumed 3.5 degrees, and an airspeed 5 knots faster than calculated VREF would entirely use up the 60% rule safety margin. The intent of the original June 2006 notice, and I'm sure any new recommendations, will be to distinguish between what was required for dispatching using forecasted conditions and when the actual runway and actual conditions are known. The last group seemed to be under the misimpression that the 15% landing assessment rule would only apply to contaminated runways, much like the Part 135, 91K, and 91 rules to add 15% to the pre-flight dispatch rule for wet runways. Though the impetus for this landing assessment came as a result of the Chicago Midway 737 overrun, and much of that accident was attributed to snow and icy conditions and failure to deploy thrust reversers, the direction of the FAA has been to require the assessment on all landings. Adding 15% to a dry runway calculation is barely adequate to cover the normal operations on a dry runway, let alone on contaminated conditions such as standing water or slush, which may require a landing distance 50% longer than the dry runway values plus the 15% safety margin. The reason most manufacturers do not provide approved contaminated runway data is because the listed distances are not based on observed, i.e. flight tested, and duplicatable results, but rather on mathematical derivations of dry runway data. The original notice in 2006 allowed operators to use this supplemental data if provided by the manufacturer. Where the 15% comes from is a bit of a mystery. The FAA's adoption of it appears to be merely an acceptance of the European standard. The above point deserves repeating. The assessment rule being considered, whatever the percentage ends up being, is a safety margin to be added to the factored landing distance. The factored distance is the dry runway distance modified to account for runway, environmental, and pilot technique conditions. A side note on this issue. One glaring problem throughout the world is the standardization of braking reports. To this end, I believe the ARC recommendations will include sections on standardizing these reports, such as using a simple good, poor, nil scale. Whether the rules will be extended to all turbine operators or just op-specable entities is yet to be announced, but in my opinion, every pilot on every flight should calculate the landing distance, factoring all actual conditions plus the safety margin. Considering these observations, I hope you will share in my bewilderment to the opposition of a modest landing assessment rule. I write more detail on the subject, including approach and landing climb gradients in my book mentioned previously. Again, if you mention you heard about the book through the podcast, you can receive 20% off. The address is www.cavucompanies.com, where you can find out more about the EFB Pro Performance Calculator as well. Well, so long for now. I'm James Duvall, and thanks for listening.